First of all, good luck.
Shavuot Tov.
It's very wonderful to be here. I've heard about this minion here in Bethesda for many years. I'm close to Rabbi Brandreth, and already so I'm aware of the minion going back to his days. And then Rabbi Rosenbaum, and then Rabbi Singer.
Rabbi Sussman.
So I seem to connect it to at least, I don't know how far back it goes before Rabbi Brandreth, thinking he started it, right? If I call correctly.
Say again?
Rabbi Brandreth.
No, he was already 10 years old when he came in.
Okay.
So he was the first rabbi.
He was the first rabbi. Okay, so there I go. So it's wonderful to be here. Number two, I'm very close with Rabbi Singer, Baruch Hashem. We've had many, many wonderful conversations together. And whatever praise he says about me, I want you to point out that you're dealing with a premier Talmud Chacham, and I'm very impressed with him. I actually happen to know his parents very well also, who are here.
You don't hold that against him.
actually, I think it enhances that. So the topic is, of course, this very exciting topic about death. I did it. Somewhere other, like, how do you make that exciting, right?
How do you draw people out for that one?
Right, exactly. How do you do that? And there's all these jokes you can make about it, but I'm not going to go there. So we did that already. I want to share with you a fascinating insight which I saw many years ago, and it took me many years to absorb what he's saying. And I'm going to share with you what I think he's trying to say. So if it comes out beautiful, it's his. If it doesn't, then it's my fault. So there's a wonderful sefer. The name of the sefer is called Alei Shur. So this work is written by a person named Rabbi Volba, Alav Shalom, and he lived in Eretz Yisrael. He was a man with tremendous insights. He was the Mashkiach's Mashkiach. He was the person who that you would have in each yeshiva. You would have an individual called the Mashkiach, which meant he was the person, the dean of men. He knew his students. He knew what they needed, and he was there for them. He was the person that all of them would go to when they had a question. This is the person they would go to. Is Rabbi Volba. Rabbi Volba put out a work anonymously, actually, in the 60s. Went through many revisions afterwards. The name of the sefer is called Alei Shur. And in this Alei Shur, he divides his work into four sections. He calls each one a shar. Each one is a gate, an introduction into some concept. The first one is the basic knowledge a person has to know if he wants to develop himself, becoming involved in his awareness of why a person is here in this world, and what his goals in life are. Second section is a little more intense, a little deeper. Third section is, okay, now you've really developed the basic skills, let's start getting to understand yourself. Talk about a lot of introspection, understanding, etc. Then the fourth section is, okay, now you're ready to go out. Let's start talking about the steps of moving outwards. And the first chapter in that section deals with marriage, and then being a parent, and then it talks about being a member of the community, and then it talks about the whole world, etc. Keep expanding outwards, seeing yourself as part of this great vision, etc. And then he has a chapter called Death. And he says that this is the final culmination of the process of moving outwards. That's how he starts the chapter. And I remember the first time I read it, I said, what is he saying? There's obviously something very deep here, something very important here, and I don't know what he's talking about. Right? So that was like the first time I read it. And I think I got it. I think I get it. And then let me share with you what I think he's trying to say. And I think from that, it gives you a tremendous understanding of what life is about from this thought. A child is born, is very self-centered. Right? 2-month-old, 3-month-old, 4-month-old. He's hungry, he's wet, something. So he starts screaming. And that's 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, it's not nice to wake up your parents at 3 o'clock in the morning. He doesn't care, right? You know, that's not his focus. His focus in life is himself. As we move, as we get older, we start becoming aware that you have to share your toys with the children around, right? There's a book, I think it's called Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, right? Like, you know, make sure that you sleep a good enough sleep every day, make sure you eat well, share your toys, right, etc. That's it, that's life, right? There you go. Kindergarten. And then you move onwards. So a person is, the goal in life is to move from being this very self-centered individual to this individual which sees the world. And there's two ways to see the world. You see the world where you see it, and you interact with it, etc. And then there's the person who really gets it. He really is able to get into somebody else's position, situation, somebody else's mind, empathize with them, feel with the person, and be there for them. And it takes a tremendous amount of wisdom. It takes a tremendous amount of not being self-centered. So Rabbi Vobel writes in a different work, he once gave, he was working with a group of young men to expand their understanding of Gemilas Chesed, of Chesed, of loving kindness. He gave them an assignment. This is the first week of the this group. Go out there and for 2 weeks, don't do anything. Just contemplate three times a day, meet somebody that you meet, what do you think their needs are? Three times a day for 2 weeks, you meet somebody, somebody new, can be the postman, can be whatever, start from you see them, think about what their needs are. And he comes back after 2 weeks, and he has the conversation with the young men, and he's recording this experiment, and they come back, and basically they found, all these people involved, that most people you meet have very similar needs to themselves. Maybe, you know, certain points different, but in general, it's pretty much the same. So he was not very happy with that. Because that's not true. What happened is they're basically seeing themselves, they're trying to be nice, so they project themselves onto other people. What would I need in that situation? And the problem is that most of us have this problem. You know, I meet somebody in a situation which is unique and I've never experienced it. How do I relate to it? How do I get them? How do I understand them? What I've been through, I can relate to. And I can imagine what they're going through. Something which I've never been through, how can I relate to what their needs are? And so that's not chesed if I can just project myself into somebody else. Because I'm not seeing the other person, I'm seeing myself. So where is that moment where a person gets the clarity to stop focusing on themselves? The goal of this last section of this work, is to have the person expand. When you get married, the point is not to interact with your wife, it's understand another human being, whose background is different than you, and in many ways they're different than you. You put them together constantly, 24/7, 365, with this individual who's different than you. And the goal is to respect them to the point that their understanding and their vision and their vantage point is just as valid or maybe more valid than yours. To see where they're coming from. That's marriage. When you can master that, you can do it with your children because your children are quite different than you. And you're going to come in, one second. You know, maybe he's right or you're wrong. Maybe he's seeing it from a vantage point that you don't understand where he's coming from. If you'll see where he's coming from, you'll be able to validate them. You'll be able to give them the self-confidence. You'll be able to understand them, what their needs are. Okay, now you want to do it with your neighbor. You want to do it with the community. You want to do it with at work. But there's always this problem because we tend to see the world from our little space. There's one point in a person's life where that's guaranteed that that's not true anymore. That's the moment of death. For that person, at that moment, the person says, you know what? It's not about me. It's not about me. Clearly it's not about me. I'm leaving here. I'm not in control anymore. I have this. I have a group of young men that are engaged, and whenever I have a group of young boys that are engaged, so I like to speak to them about marriage. Not that I'm the biggest expert about marriage, but you can ask my wife. But I tell you, when I was married about 5 years, I did something really, really not on target with my wife, and I really blew it, shall we say? And I went to my mentor. And I said, you know, like I'm married 5 years, I wish I would not be doing this type of things. She says to me, he says, Rebbe Leo, I'm married 25 years and I still make mistakes. So I said, Rebbe, does it make me feel better or worse? So here I am, you know, I'm dealing with this young man, you know, I'm busy talking to him. Mark says, why didn't you call me? I was busy teaching about Sholem Bayis to the young man. It doesn't work. Anyway. So here I am. So I'm talking with this young man. I said, one of the issues which you have that Rav Vobel points out in a different work, which he wrote for Chassanim, for the engaged young man, he has one for Kalvus also, is that the first real challenge to a young man in the world of bitachon, we'll translate the word in a second, is getting married. What is bitachon? Bitachon is the understanding that we live in Hashem's arms, which means we're not in control. Somebody else is in control. You get into the bus, I get into a car, and I'm with somebody, and I get into the passenger seat. I'm only getting into that car if I trust the driver. That's called bitachon. I trust. There's different types of trust. There's the passenger gets into the other seat and falls asleep. Totally confident that the driver knows what they're doing, they're ready to go to sleep. there's a driver gets on the other side, and they're using their virtual brake. Mm-hmm. You know, they have the virtual brake. You know, slow down.
Now you're talking about my wife.
And then you're ready at any moment to grab the wheel just in case. You know, I trust him, but right. So I said, there's a strange thing which we have with these young. That I don't. It's not all men, you know. But like, you know, I can't, you know, thought of, you know, Mars and Venus. But men like to be the driver, not the passenger, because they like control. I want to be in control, and it's much more comfortable to be in control when I'm driving. I'm in control. Right? Greyhound, the Greyhound. You know, I've been on the bus. Like, let's go tell the driver to take a different route. Like, you know, will you excuse me? It's his job. No, you're still asleep. Right, you know. That's a control issue that we have. The men have. Okay. Marriage is the first time when you have this individual you can't control. Basically, a young man's life until he gets married, he pretty much decides what he wants to do, what he doesn't want to do, etc. Also, you have this individual who doesn't bend to your will. Right? And you have to learn to respect. And that's the first time you're learning this, that the focus is not yourself. And that's what marriage does. And then your children are really good for that. Ray Singer was just giving us. I'll give you a story, which parallels the story he was just telling me. So it's great. I talked to my chassan. I'm going to tell him that humor is very important. Learn to laugh at yourself. Be comfortable laughing at yourself. So here I am. I take my son. He's like 5 years old, and he would walk with me to shul every Shabbos. And of course, he couldn't sit and daven all the time. You know, he had his little snack pack, and he had his book to read, and he had etc. But even so, like. And he had this habit, it happened a few times during Shemoneh Esrei when the whole place is quiet, he would start like making noise, you know, doing something. So like, you know, and of course, and it really wasn't so loud, but as a parent right next to him, it sounds like the sounds of the sledgehammer, because like, you know, the whole place is like looking at him and staring at him, you know, like, it's just a little kid, like making noise, like nobody else notices but you, right? So I this Shabbos morning next week, I said, you know, I have to speak to him about it. And on the way to shul, I decide I'm going to explain to him that you can't do that during Shemoneh Esrei. And he's smart enough to know what Shemoneh Esrei is, etc. And I speak to him, and then we have this great conversation, and I will explain to him, after this 5-year-old, right, that he shouldn't do this during Shemoneh Esrei. So of course, what happens during Shemoneh Esrei? He does it, right? That's exactly what happens, right? And I, you know, so my first emotion was like, you know, getting a little bit tense. And I think, you know, I just spoke to him. Like, and here he is, like, ignoring me. And, you know, you have all these different emotions. Like, you know, he's a 5-year-old kid. Like, you move on. And I said, you know, so I said to myself, you know what, Reingold? You know what? You know, I run this yeshiva. And I have, like, you know, tens and tens of students I give direction to, and they're supposed to listen to me, etc. I can't get my 5-year-old kid to listen to me. Like, you know, who do I think I am? And it was like, I just started giggling in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei. I just lost it. Like, here I am, I think this is a great rabbi, you know. I can't get this 5-year-old kid to listen to me. I just lost it. You know, and it released all my tension. Like, I'm not upset anymore. It's funny. Who do I think I was? Right? It's pretty funny. Like, you know, but it gave me clarity. Like, you know, this is it. Okay? We're going to learn. He's individual. He has his own needs, his own way of doing things. He's his own man. And I have to respect that. We had this once. Like, he's like, I don't know, 5 years old, 4 or 5 years old. My wife says to me, why won't he listen? I said, male ego. He said, 5-year-old kid. I said, yeah, male ego. You know, this is the way it is. Come on. This is the way they come. Okay. So that, and our neighbors for sure are like that. But we really have to start seeing the world through their eyes. We're going to be able to interact with them in a respectful way. And be able to understand what their needs are and be able to empathize when they have a challenge. And there's no greater moment of that movement from inside of yourself, out and out and outwards, than the day of death, which gives you that clarity. It's the day where you realize you're not in control, you never were in control of your life. Your the whole lifetime really belonged to somebody else, it belonged to your Creator. He decides when to give you life, when not. So then if that's true and that's clear to us, so of course, why am I focusing on myself? Why am I not noticing the person next to me? Not just noticing them, but being aware, empathizing, understanding, respecting, getting into their mindset, seeing the world from their position. Why is it me? Why am I right? Like, you know, usually have these people tell you, listen, like, I get it, sort of get it right. Everybody above me is like a little bit too much, a little too little. You know, I get it right. Why? Who said? How do I know? There's such a clarity from that moment. There's a famous, fascinating concept that the sages say that the divine presence rests over a deathly ill person. So the question is, why does the divine presence come over a deathly ill person? So Rabbi Volbe, in his work on Chumash, suggests because when we live in a situation where we're dependent on somebody else, then we can recognize our Creator. And that's when the divine presence comes over there. That clarity that we're dependent on somebody else, somebody outside of ourselves, gives that clarity to see Hashem. Because otherwise we focus on, we sort of get the world, where what it's about, etc. The opposite of that is the Gemara. The Gemara says, the speaker of Ashal Shuddha, somebody else in Yeshiva, suggested this idea. The opposite of that is, it wasn't myself. There's a Gemara, the Gemara says in Sota that a person who's a Balgaiva, a person who is this non-humble person, this person who's boastful, etc. God says he and I can't live in the same world. There's not enough room in here for the two of us. So what happens? God lets him live. He sort of steps away. He says, "You know what? Fine, you do it. It's your life. You take over. I'm out of here." One of my rabbis once suggested that there's a story we have in the Chumash of Nadav Avihu. They go into the Kodesh Kedoshim and they die. So what was their sin? What did they do wrong? So one explanation was that they had gaiva. So God says, "Listen, I'm a nice guy. I don't have room for the two of us, the person who has the gaiva, the person who has this arrogance. And I'll give you space. But there's one space where you walk into. So I'm not leaving here." Go to the Kodesh Kedoshim, God says, "Listen, it's me or you. I'm staying. You're done." Right? And that's what happens. This gaiva, the arrogance, the thing, we get it right. There's a leader, there's a Moshe and Aaron. Why did you ask them? Why did you decide to do it on yourself without speaking to them? But according to one opinion, they didn't even ask each other. They just trusted themselves totally. Total confidence, which is a good thing. But, you have to balance it. And that was what we fault them with. And there's no day which doesn't give you that clarity. A bit greater than that. But end with one quick thought, a little bit different twist. I once heard this on a tape, and then I also subsequently saw it written in a work by a person by Avigdor Miller. Rabbi Miller, there we go. Rabbi Miller. So Rabbi Miller has this thought. You read the Chumash. The first generations live very long. Now I'm a procrastinator. Okay, I'm a procrastinator. My wife is not, Baruch Hashem, but I am. Right. So I don't understand. I can't imagine the challenge to a procrastinator if you live to be 950 years old. I'll get to it 300 years from now. Like, there's time. Don't worry, we'll get to it eventually. 350 years from now, you can imagine that challenge. It says the value of something. There's nothing more valuable in the world than air. Do we appreciate air? The only time a person appreciates and thinks about the fact is when he can't get it. He's underwater. He has his tank. He looks at the dial and says 3 minutes left, and he's 5 minutes from the surface. Then you appreciate air. When it becomes limited, you appreciate it. A person, water is the second most important thing. We don't really think about water so much. A person's in a desert, there's no water available, instead of thinking about the lack of water. When it's not available, when it's limited, then you appreciate it. Supply and demand tells you that the more limited something is, the more valuable it has. That's not really true in life. That's true in economics. It's not true in life. Diamonds are not as valuable as air. There's nothing more valuable than air. But diamonds sell for a lot more than air does. But where do we learn to appreciate the value of the most valuable thing, which is not even air, it's life? It's when it's limited. If a person will live for 900 years, it's very hard to appreciate the value of every moment. How do you appreciate the value of every moment? You know what? It's not so long. A person has, a limited amount of time here. He says, I got to take advantage of the time that I have. I can't procrastinate. So it's the greatest appreciation of the most beautiful jewel that we have, which is life itself, requires that there has to be an end. So the Medrash says, God's everything that he did, and it was very good. So the Medrash says that Tov is life, Tov Ma'od, very good, is death. The most valuable thing that there is in this world is life. But the only way we're going to appreciate it is from the prism of the fact that it ends at some point. So we left you with two thoughts. That we have learned that it gives us appreciation of life, but even more gives appreciation and understanding that it's not about us. And that there's somebody else who's in control. Be aware of him. Be aware of the people around us. Be aware of the world. And learn to empathize, to sympathize, to empathize, to understand, to respect. And that is the lesson which the moment of death gives to us for life. Thank you for listening.